We're on Nun Aleph Amud Aleph, two lines from the top.
Nun Aleph?
Yep.
Wow.
We're moving ahead. We're almost halfway through the Masechta, Baruch Hashem. Okay.
Amud
Aleph.
Next time you come, we'll be doing Sanhedrin.
Nah, I'm not coming that often. No, we're holding by the two lines from the top of Nun Aleph. Okay. So we had been talking yesterday about this whole issue of what kind of nechasim do the yisoimim get, or the yisoimos mainly, get their support out of. We said that the yisoimos, the girls, are entitled to mezonos after the father passes away. We started discussing yesterday the question, does that take place only from karka, which is what the Mishnah seems to imply and what Rav Amnuna said, or is there maybe a later takana that also metoplin can be used for the purpose? And we mentioned that after the times of the Gemara and the times of the Goyim, they made a takana that metoplin is more generally used for these kinds of things, but obviously the Gemara is not dealing with that, because that came only afterwards. So another case, Ahu Yosim v'Yisoyim ad also v'kamei de Rava. There was once a boy and a girl, both Yisoyim, who came to Rava. They had, again, there's an estate that's being managed for them by an apotropos, by a trustee. They came to Rava to ask for mezonos. So Rava told them, go ahead and give the Yosin, go ahead and give the boy extra mezonos, so that way his sister can be included as well. Meaning even from the metalpilin, not just from the karka. Amr le Rabbanan le Rava. So the Rabbanan said to Rava, why? You yourself said, which we'll have at the end of the sugya, right before the Mishnah, that Rava himself said that the rule is you only take from karka, not from metalpilin, for any of these purposes, whether it's for mazon, whether it's for sustaining the girls until for a year or until they get married or whatever. No, not payrus, for them to be able to eat, for them to be able to have food and clothes and whatever, is mazonos, is regular daily stuff that they need for their daily maintenance, right. for their daily upkeep.
So
one second. Vein l'ksuba, and as far as the almana collecting the ksuba, or the son's yarshining it, ksuba's been in dichrin that we talked about yesterday, or vein l'parnasa, or whether we're talking about parnasa, the girl's wedding expenses, the nadin.
Mekarka means what?
Mekarka means exactly that, from karka.
Meaning,
in other words, Rava is saying that the Yerusha itself, the estate itself, obviously consists of both Karka and Metalpilin. As we said yesterday when Rav Amnuna had said that the boys only inherit from Karka, and everybody yelled at him, and Rav Hotya and Rav Yosef said that meant Ksubas Benin Dichrin. The regular Yerusha, of course, includes Metalpilin. You don't take... When it comes to the rule, the Tanai Ksuba, that we're saying that the girls get maintenance, that the girls get mezonos until they get married, and the almana gets the son, not the almana, the sons get to collect the ksubas benin dichrin, their mother's ksuba, and the girls later on are entitled to parnasa, to money towards their wedding expenses. All those things are only taken out of karka.
Meaning you have to sell the karka?
Yeah, you sell the karka. Meaning, in other words, if all there is metalpilin, then you don't take those. Bistin doesn't force the Yisoyim to sell those metalpilin to raise money for those things.
Can you lease it? Can you lease the karka for the income?
Yeah, whatever it is. I mean, but the point is that you can only collect out of karka.
Right.
Yeah. So then, what are you saying that in this case you should have the apotropos sell some of these metalpilin for okay? So if it was only a boy, in other words, sure. I mean, he's the Yorish, so fine. You know, of course, whatever is needed to sustain him, you both karka and metalpilin, it all belongs to him. So the apotropos sells whatever is necessary in order to have money for his food and clothes and whatever else he needs. But why are we saying that you should include? Why are we saying you should include the girl when you're selling metalpilin? So Rava tells him like this. Think of it this way. Suppose that there wasn't a sister over here. Suppose that this boy needed a shifcha to serve him, to take care of him, to help. He's a little boy, after all. He needs somebody to help around the house. Wouldn't we say then that the apotropos should go and sell some of those metalpilin to get money to buy him a shifcha, to buy him a helper around the house? Well, then all the more so, we would say the same thing over here. You have those both things. Number one, she's his sister. She may not be one of the heirs, after all, because he is the sole heir. But still, she is far a child of the person who passed away. So therefore, on those grounds, she's entitled to mezonos anyway, from karka maybe, not from a metalpilin, but still. Like this, you're killing two birds with one stone. You're supporting her, which is supposed to be done as one of the Tanai Tzuba. And number two, she'll keep the house. She'll keep the house running for her brother.
How do we know that then? They don't yet have mentality. So where do we learn that up?
So we discussed yesterday the idea that since the Ksuvas Benin Dichrin only applies to Karka, then therefore so does the Muzin of the Almona and Bonis also only apply to Karka.
Mentality
is only for the Yoshim, only for the actual Yoshim, yeah. So Koshkinocha de Katarki, so how much more so here there's two valid considerations why she should be getting the Zionists. And she's a sister, so she's one of the heirs, she should be entitled to Mazonis anyway. And number two, she's helping around the house.
Why doesn't help a sister to Mazonis?
No, but the point is, once she's given that she's his sister, she's entitled to something out of the estate. Instead of, in this case, selling Kauka for that purpose, you have to sell Metalkalin for him anyway. So include his sister, and because that way it's serving the boy's purposes because she cooks and cleans and whatever and keeps the house running. Yeah, but that's the Tauti. In other words, once you're saying that's Hashem Shenu, she's going to run the household. Then already it's the fact that she's his sister entitles her to Mazonis. The fact that Tishem Shenu, not from Metalpolin per se, but the fact that Tishem Shenu makes it from Metalpolin as well. And for that reason, by the way, the Mefarshim say that for that reason, this would, even though usually the thing of Mazonis only applies as long as she's a Ketana or a Naira, because at that point already she's a marriageable age and should be striking out on her own. But in this case, if we're talking about that we're supporting her because she's helping her brother, because she's keeping house for her brother, then it can apply even when she's a Begeris. If he's little, yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe even if he's not so little. You ever see a butler's apartment? Yeah. Turn it up on him. More on this topic. Echad nechasim sheyesh lehen achrayus, ve'echad nechasim she'ein lehen achrayus. Whether it's nechasim for which there is achrayus or nechasim for which there is not. Nechasim she'ein lehen achrayus and nechasim sheyesh lehen achrayus is Gemara terminology for, respectively, karka and metalflin. Karka is called nechasim sheyesh lehem achrayus because those are the kind of properties that a bal chayv is able, that are a creditor, somebody to whom the person owed money is able to go and take them away from buyers, as we've talked about before. So therefore, they're called nechasim sheyesh lehem achrayus, where there's an absolute responsibility, there's a lien on them that was created by the chayv. Nechasim shein lehem achrayus is metalpelin, because a bal chayv is not, according to the original din of the Gemara, a bal chayv is not entitled to collect from those if they were sold to somebody else.
Today's situation, would you consider a car really a metalpelin, but there is a chayus and it's not karka.
Bepashas would be considered metalpelin.
Yes.
But again, according to the Takanot HaGaonim, there's not really a difference between karka and metalpelin for the most part. For the most part, all the genium that the Gemara said about karka, many of them apply nowadays to metalpelin also based on that Takana.
If somebody buys metalpelin, he goes away and they say he can't find it anymore.
Yeah.
But here we define karka because it has achrayus.
No, but achrayus means that the fact that balei chayv are able to take that away. No, we're not talking about obviously. No, of course. If you lease anything, you don't make up your payment and you don't make your payments, then the guy can take it away. We're not talking about that. We're talking about Reuven borrowed money from Shimon.
Right.
Meanwhile, after he borrowed money from Shimon, at some point he went and sold one of his fields to Levi. Now comes the time for the payment of the debt. Reuven doesn't have enough money to pay Shimon. Shimon is entitled to go take that property that he sold to Levi and take it in satisfaction of the debt. Yeah. That's why I told Nechasim Sheyesh Lehem
Achrayus. There's no karka at all.
There's no karka at all. Then all you can take from is metalpelin, b'nei chori.
And she had nothing from it.
What?
What did her sister
have? Oh, in the previous case? In the previous case? No, in the previous case we said that the sister also gets from metalpelin. But now we're on to a new thing. Now we're on to a brice that's going to discuss this issue further. So echad nechasim sheyesh lehen achrayus, ve'echad nechasim sheyesh lehen achrayus, whether it's karka or metalpelin, moitzin lemazon ishu olavanos. You take out from them for the mazonis of the wife, of the widow, and for the daughters. Divrei Rebbe. So according to Rebbe, there's no all these discussions that we were talking about all this time, karka versus metalpelin. According to Rebbe, it doesn't make a difference.
You take from either one.
From either one or the other. Reb Shimon Elazar, no. It's like this. Nechasim sheyesh la nachrayis. When it comes to karka, motziim labonis min abonim, then we do take away from the boys to give to the girls, to give their mezonos. All the bonis min abonis, also from one group of daughters to the other. Meaning, what if there's only daughters? What if a person died with only daughters? Well, then we know who the daughters, Yash and everything. So what happens? Suppose that among the daughters over there, there are older girls and younger girls. So the older ones went and grabbed a hold of the nechassim and then were machzik in them. And meanwhile, their little sisters couldn't prevent it. Nevertheless, we take it away. There's no mezonos in this case because they're all equal yoshim, but Beis Din will take away an appropriate amount from the older girls to give a fair share of the yerusha to their younger sisters. Also, they'll do the same thing if you have different sets of boys. Same idea. You have the older boys went and grabbed a hold of all the nechassim. Beis Din will make them redivided equally with their brothers. Ulabonim minabonis minachassim berubin. And also, Rav Shimon Elazar says that you'll take away karka from the girls to give to the boys if there's a lot of nechassim. What do we mean by that? This that we've been talking about all this time, that the girls are entitled to mezonos and parnasa, etc., all of that applies in a case of nechassim merubin, where after you subtract the amount that's earmarked for the girls, there's still something left for the boys to yarshin. That's called nechassim merubin. Nechassim mu'atim is that we say there's not enough for all of that. Then we say we give the girls their mezonos and their parnasa. There's nothing left for the boys. Okay, there's nothing left for the boys. If they have to, they'll go begging. So if there's nechassim merubin and the girls went and grabbed a hold of all of the nechassim, claiming we need it from mezonos and parnasa and whatnot, then we'll take away as long as Beis Din will figure out, no, exactly how much do you need from mezonos and parnasa, and the rest goes to your brothers because they're the yoshim. Avalei benechassim watin, Avalei lebonim and abonis benechassim watin, but you won't take away from the girls to give to the boys if there's nechassim watin, because then by definition the girls get their mezonos and the boys are left with nothing. That's all Rav Shimon.
The girls have precedence.
The girls have precedence in the sense that, yeah, so because of the takana of the chacham, and mezonos and parnasa, therefore they have precedence as far as collecting that stuff. It's earmarked for them. Yeah, it's earmarked for them. And yeah, we're going to have later on in the last parak a series of machlokas in between the dayonis gzeris of Yerushalayim and the chachamim on various topics. One of them is going to be on this business of why should the boys lose out and men's rights. So we'll get to that towards the end of the Masechta Beis Din. So that's what Rosh Hashanah Lazar is saying. That's as far as karka. What about metalpolin? Then metzian labonim and abonim and labonis and abonis. Then yes, if there's different boys and the older ones have grabbed all the nechassim, we'll take away an appropriate amount and give to their younger brothers. And the same thing with girls. If the girls are the yorishim, same idea. You split it evenly among them. Or labonim and abonis. Also when it comes to metalpolin, if the girls have grabbed everything, claiming that they need it from mezonos and parnasa, we'll take away the appropriate amount to give the boys to yarshim because they are the yarshim after all. Avaloi labonis min abonim, but not the other way around. Not if the boys have yarshim all the metalpolin and now the girls are demanding mezonos and parnasa. That Rav Shimon Elazar says we don't take out of metalpolin, which agrees with everything that we were saying before, that there's a difference between karka and metalpolin when it comes to mezonos. So we have a machlokas between Rebbe and Rav Shimon Elazar about the question. The underlying issue in this braisa is basically, do the girls get their mezonos out of metalpolin or not? And the Gemara points out, usually we have a rule throughout Shas that when Rebbe argues with one other tana, then the halacha is like him. So here, logically, the halacha should be like Rebbe. No, halacha Rav Shimon Elazar. Here we see that the halacha is actually like Rav Shimon Elazar.
When the rule is when you have...
Usually when Rebbe is arguing against halacha ki Rebbe mechazei roi v'loi mechazei rov, that if Rebbe argues against one Tana, then the halacha is like him. If he argues against the chachamim, then the halacha is not. This is an exception. How do we see it's an exception? Dama Rava, because we see Rava says, we quoted it before, hilchasa, the halacha is memekauki v'loi memetalpili, that the halacha is you collect only from karka, not from metalpilin, bein l'ksuba, whether it's as far as the boys yarshining l'ksuba, bein l'mezoni, whether it's as far as girls mezonis, bein l'parnasa, or whether it's their parnasa, their wedding expenses.
So they only get from the karka.
They only get from karka.
In other words, there's no karka, they don't get. they don't get.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Okay. Okay. It is how it is. I mean, again, with the
Tachanas. Okay. They got to go out something to collect.
No, no. Okay, whatever. So they go to Karen some Chachos and Rikava. Yeah, whatever, you know.
Yeah. They would do it. They have to do it.
We're not saying that we shouldn't convince the Yisoyimim to give them, but there's no absolute obligation on them. Tosfos mentions that actually there's a difference. There's actually a difference. This that Rava is saying that you only collect from Karka is when we mentioned yesterday the concept of Omid or Loy Omid, whether we know what the father would have wanted to do. If we know that the father would have wanted to make sure that they have a decent Nadan, then they have a right to collect from the Talpulin as well, because if he were still alive, he would have given them the Talpulin as well. This that we're saying the halacha is that you don't collect from the Talpulin is where we don't have this umdana, where we don't have this knowledge of what the father would have done. Or maybe Fakir, when you know that the father was a chief guy, whatever. Takanas Hagoyim is a different thing. Takanas Hagoyim is after the Gemara. Yeah. Well, the time has changed. We talked yesterday because there came a point when most Jews didn't own land anymore.
Talking before the Takanas Hagoyim.
Yeah, this Gemara here is talking before the Takanas Hagoyim, right? There is, by the way, there is a machloikas Rishonim about this last point over here. Do we say, when we say the Takanas Hagaonim, does it apply across the board to all these things, Suba and Mazoni and Parnasa? The Sheilta says that even after the Takanas Hagaonim, Parnasa is still an exception. Most other Rishonim say it's not.
It does apply.
That you can collect, that the girls are entitled to collect Parnasa, wedding expenses, out of Metalpulin as well. The whole concept, I mean, it is a Takanas Hagaonim, but it's actually based on something from the Gemara. I think it's later on in Or Masechta that I think the Gemara mentions, I think, in Arabia or something like that, that it was very common for people to own camels. Maybe that's similar to your case of the car from before. Like, everybody owned a camel, and therefore, it was just like in Babel, everybody owned land, and in Arabia, everybody owned a camel. So it was like, you know, yes, the Baal HaKlevis could expect to collect from such a thing. So therefore, the Gaonim applied that more generally to Metalpilin. Yeah. We talked before, the previous Mishnayos have been talking about Tnoi Ksuba, so our Mishnah continues on that topic. Loi Kosov L'Ksuba, if the husband did not write a Ksuba for his wife, nevertheless, B'Sula Gvigam Asayim Ba'al Mona Mona. If she's a B'Sula, she still gets 200. At the end of the marriage, that Mona gets a Mona. Mepnei Shiru Tnai Basin, because it's Tnai Basin, then it has to be that minimum amount. Another case, Kosov L'Sada Shova Mona Takas Masayim Zuz. What if the husband wrote out for her in the Ksuba that he pledges to give her for the ksuba a field which really is worth 100, saying that that's going to be instead of the 200 zuz. V'loy kosev lo kol nechosim de isli achroyin l'ksubasech, and he did not write in the ksuba that all the nechosim I have are achroy to the ksuba. In other words, what it comes out, according to this, is he wrote in the ksuba that if I die or divorce you, that I'm going to give you this field. Which that field we send assessors and we find out it's worth 100 zuz, but he's putting it in the ksuba as if it was worth 200. So if he had said that all the other nechasim are achroyim, we would say fine, she gets that field plus whatever else it takes to bring it up to 200 zuz. But in this case he didn't. Nevertheless, chayev, he's still chayev to make up the whole 200. Shurutnai again because shurutnai based in. Now there are some mafarshim who explain that actually the Mishnah is talking two different cases. One is he wrote out a field that's worth 100 instead of 200. And the other case is he wrote out a field that's 200, but he didn't write that all the other nechasim are achroyim for it. Then it would mean if that field is not available, then she's entitled to collect from something else.
Oh, maybe if the field is not available?
Well, if it's available, then yeah, she'll collect from that. Sure, why not? Mefarshim point out that that's the chiddush of this part of the Mishnah. In Bava Metzia, in Perek Hazav, the fourth Perek of Bava Metzia, most of that Perek deals with the dinim of Aynah, of overcharging or undercharging, and what the din is. Aynah does not apply to Karka. Even you have a piece of land which you have a real estate expert checks out and he says it's worth only 100, but you're claiming it's worth 200 and somebody is willing to buy it from you for 200, fine. Location. There's no fixed value for Karka. Nevertheless, so you would think over here then, he's claiming that he's writing into the ksuba that I'm setting aside this karka for your ksuba as if it was worth 200. You might think that given the dinim of Aynah, it's not a problem. No, the Mishnah is telling us that doesn't work. Next, Loi kosavla, what if he did not write in the ksuba, im tishtaboy, if you get captured by goyim, efer tinoch, I will redeem you, I'll bail you out, v'isvinoch lo lila into, and I will return you to me to as my wife, uvepehenes, or if she's the wife of a kohen, where then when she's a shvuyah, he's not allowed to remarry her, to continue living with her, as we learned previously, then if he doesn't write adrinoch lemidinosach, that I will be responsible for redeeming you and returning you back to your original city. Nevertheless, chayev sure tnai based in. Again, he's chayev to do those things because that's tnai based in. It's one of the tnai ksuba. We learned the other day that he gets the payrus of her property and in return he's obligated to redeem her.
Whatever the case, he writes or he doesn't write.
So whether he writes or he doesn't, that's what we're saying. That's what we're saying. We're listing a whole bunch of things that even if they're not written in the ksuba, he's still chayev. And in I've never seen any ksuba nowadays where they write this clause, but nevertheless, it's still in effect. Yeah. Nishbeis chayev lefdaisa. So if she gets captured, then he's chayev to redeem her. V'im omar. And what if the husband says, "Hare gitu ksubasa? You know what? I can't be bothered. Fine, let me give her a get. I'll pay out her ksuba. V'kifte es atzma. Let her take money out of her ksuba and redeem herself. Ein rasha. He's not allowed to do that. He doesn't have the option to do that.
I mean,
Pidyon Shvuyim would mean that Pidyon Shvuyim is not a Rishus, obviously, but it would mean, in other words, that we're saying that one of the Tanoik Suba is he has the particular responsibility, more than the general Tzibur, to redeem her. On the other hand, Loksa, if she becomes sick, Chayav L'Rapoisa, then he has to pay her medical expenses. So what if he says a similar thing as the previous case? He says, you know what, let me give her a get, let me give her a ksuba, terape es atzma, let her go pay her own medical bills. Rashi, that he's allowed to do. Now, what's the difference? Rashi says, so Rashi says briefly, and before Shem explained, so William said the good husband thing, I'll tell you in a second what the Rambam says about it. But wait, let's first talk the basic dinim. The difference is, Rashi says, as soon as she's captured, he right away becomes chayev to redeem her. It's a one-time thing. So therefore, he doesn't have the option of saying, you know what, let me get out of it. Ripui is, before Shem explained, what Rashi is saying is basically it's a day-by-day thing. It's a day-by-day thing. So fine, he pays the initial expenses, but if he says at that point, you know what, let's just, you know, we'll call it quits, she'll be my grusha, I'm not required to support her anymore, let her pay it out of her ksuba. Is it the right thing to do? No. The Rambam says that it's a disgusting thing for him to do. It's not a decent thing for him to do. But he has the right to halacha. Incidentally, by the way, the vort is also Mefarshim explained that this medical expenses are considered part of mezonos, basically. So therefore, just as with mezonos, once she's divorced, he's not required to support her anymore. That's why we're saying that rifui, that healing her, is the same thing. There is a couple of interesting things about this. First of all, the Magid Mishnah brings on the Rambam quotes from the Raivad's commentary on Sifri. The Sifri talks about the case the Yifas Toyar, the Yifas Toyar from the beginning of Parshas Kisetse. The pasuk that says over there, if you don't want to marry her, v'shilachta l'nafsha, you have to send her to go free. So the Sifri says on that means if she's sick, you can't send her away. So the Raivad learns from that, well, if that applies to a Yifas Torah, how much more so applies to a Bat Yisrael? So no, what does our Mishnah mean that he's entitled to divorce her and say, you know what, here's your ksuba, go pay your own medical bills? It's only if she's not actually sick in bed, if she's able to get up and walk out of the house. The Raivad says if she's not able to get up, she's confined to bed, then no, you don't have that option. So many other Rishonim disagree with the Raivad on that. They say that either what the Sifra is saying is only a smachta, it's not the actual halacha, or that maybe there's a difference. Hater to Yifas Toyar is like a stranger in a strange country. She was captured in battle from all. She doesn't have any family or whatever. Whereas a regular married woman is different. But one other thing, the Rashba points out in one of his Trubas an interesting thing. The fact that we're saying over here he's saying, fine, let me give her a get and pay her ksuba and let her go pay her medical bills. But we see from that you can't give her the get without paying the ksuba. If you can't afford the ksuba, then no, you don't have the right to divorce her. Again, that also, not all the parties can agree with that point. But there is that point.
So maybe he may lose in the deal if the ksuba is more than the medical expenses.
Well, yeah, but so you know what the Gemara is going to also talk about. The Gemara on Nunbeis is going to talk about whether there's a difference in this regard between a short term illness or a long term illness, where like there may be years worth of medical expenses we're talking about over here versus a short term thing where you know it's a couple of weeks and then yeah. So the Gemara starts off Mani. Now the first part of our Mishnah. And that talks about that the minimum is the 200 and the 100, and you can't go any less than that, even if you didn't write Aruch Tzuva. Mani, who would that be according to? Rav Meir. That seems to be according to Rav Meir. D'Amar Kol Apochus L'Bsulim Masayim Al Amonim Imana. He says we're going to have more about it in the next parak. Or actually later in this parak. If you do any less than 200 for a Bsula or 100 for an Amana, it is the beginning of the next parak actually. Rav Meir says, "Harezu be'ilas snus." Then it's considered be'ilas snus. It's considered it's not a legal marriage.
Well, the mana
or the masayim makes it legal. Yeah. Why does it have to be Rav Meir? De'ir Rav Yehuda, because according to Rav Yehuda, ha'amar, doesn't Rav Yehuda say rotsa kosev l'psula shtar shemasayim? That, for example, he says also at the beginning of the next parak that, for example, the husband, if he wants, can write out a shtar, can write out a ksuba for a psula that says that he owes her 200 zuzas the ksuba, that he could say that, and she can in return write back a document that says he's kabalti mimcha money. I received out of that a money. And she really didn't. But effectively, she's being loyal on half her ksuba and saying you're only on the hook for 100 in case you die. She can if she wants to. Similarly, similarly, when it comes to an amana, he can write a ksuba that says mana, he could say, it's kabbalat b'mchol 50 zuz. She can write out that I received half of it, 50 zuz. In other words, according to Rabbi Yehuda, we're not saying necessarily that she has to be guaranteed 200 or 100. So therefore, our Mishnah that's saying that she has to be guaranteed that, it's snai based in, must be according to the mayor.
Can't raise it up and say, I want 300.
No, well, of course not. Not unless they wrote specifically, but yeah. Okay, the problem with that, Ema Sefer, but look at the next part of the Mishnah. The Mishnah continued that if he wrote out in the Ksuba, he mentioned a field that's worth 100 in place of the 200 Zuz. And he did not write that all the other Nechasim that I have are all Achrayus, they're all mortgaged towards the Ksuba. We say Chayev, he's nevertheless Chayev to pay the full 200, and all his property is all Meshubat, pure Tanai based in. Asan the Rabbi Yehuda. Now that part of the Mishnah seems to be according to Rabbi Yehuda. The Amar Achrayus Toas Sefer, who he says that if you have, in general, when you sell property, we talked about this the other day, that when you sell property, when you sell real estate to somebody, there's usually a clause that's included in the shtar called Achrayus. If one of my creditors, I'm Reuven, I owe money to Shimon, and now I'm going and selling a field to you, Levi. There is a chance that Shimon might at some point come and take away the field from you in payment of my debt. If that happens, I'm accepting on myself achrayus that I will reimburse you, Levi, for what for the value of the field. That's called achrayus. What happens if you didn't write achrayus in the shtar? Rabbi Yehuda holds achrayus toras seferu. The fact that no achrayus is written, that's just effectively the scribe made a mistake.
Yeah,
he's still chayiv in the achrayus. Because according to the mayor, Hama Achrayus Lav Tos Sefer, who according to the mayor, no, it has to be explicitly written in the shtar that there's Achrayus, and otherwise, well, what? I mean, one way of looking at it, it's one thing, no, everybody agrees if you specifically wrote in the shtar there's no Achrayus, then there's no question about it, fine, you know, you wanted to buy the field without Achrayus, fine, you know, you're entitled, but if no Achrayus is written, that's the question, is Achrayus the default or not, basically? Yeah. The part of it is the question of does something have to be written in a shtar for it to.
The buyer of the stuff, does the field, has always have to request a chayyim.
According to the mayor, yes.
According to
the mayor, yes. According to the beholder, no.
Right. And if he doesn't, he just.
And if it rests, then he was willing to take the risk. Yeah. Ditnan, and how do we see that machloikas Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir? The Mishnah says in Chav Masiyah, Motzei Shtorei Chayv, if somebody finds Shtorei Chayv in the street, Im Yesh Behen Achrayis Nechasim Lo Yachzir, so if the if the shtar includes that the loiver was mortgaging, was putting a lien on all his property that the malver can collect, which would be the usual situation, then lo yachzu, then you should not return it to the malver. Now, obviously, if the loiver is arguing and saying, you know what, I never wrote this shtar, it's forged, I paid, then we're nothing to talk about. But even if they both agree, the loiver says, you know what, it's true, I borrowed money from this guy, I never paid him back yet, yeah, it really belongs to him, he dropped it. Nevertheless, the Mishnah says they're lo yachzu, you still should not return the shtar, shebeist in nifrayim mehen, because what will happen if later on he defaults on the shtar, beist din is going to end up going to Levi and taking away the property from him. The problem with that is, what happens if Reuven and Shimon together are doing a knunia, a collusion? They make them up among themselves, Reuven and Shimon, you know what, I borrowed money from you, I paid you back already, but you know what, let's pretend that I never paid you back. It'll go to Beis Din. You'll sue me for it. I'll claim that I can't pay. You'll go to Levi and take away this field that I previously sold him, yeah. And then we can split it between us. So you don't. We'll make some money out of it. So you don't want to allow that. Eben achrayis nechassim. On the other hand, if the shtar does not have achrayis nechassim in it, yachzu, then you can go ahead and return it. Shein Beis Din nifrayim mehen, because then there's no third party to be harmed by it. The Beis Din anyway can't take away from any third party. Whereas the Chachamim say that it doesn't matter either way whether it says Achrayus or not, Beis Din can collect from the Mishabadim. Now we only say the Chachamim over there, but Rashi points out usually who is the usual one who argues against Reb Meir is Rabbi Yehuda. So therefore we see that Reb Meir is saying that there's a difference whether you write Achrayus or not. You can't say Achrayus Toh Sofer. If you didn't write Achrayus, then there's no Achrayus. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda is saying that, no, Achrayus Toh Sofer. If you don't have Achrayus written in the Shtar, it doesn't matter. Applying that to our Mishnah then, when our Mishnah says that the husband wrote into the Ksuba a field of 100 Zuz, and he did not write that all his other Nechasim are Achrayim, according to Rabbi Yehuda, it shouldn't matter if he wrote it or not. So of course he's still on the hook. The fact that the Mishnah has to mention Sheet Tonight based, no, so that's the thing. So that fits according to Rabbi Yehuda. Why is he chayev? Because it doesn't matter whether he wrote Achrayus or not.
What?
It doesn't matter whether he wrote Achrayus or not, according to Rabbi Yehuda.
Yeah.
So a lot of Mephoshim talk about the question, so what exactly is the Gemara's point? The Mishnah is saying that he's on the hook with Neshu Tanai based in. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it's not a question of Tanai based in or not.
Right.
It's just Achrayus Toh Sofer. So what's the actual connection? One of the answers is that the Shchayev Shur Tanai based in is not talking actually about that part, about Achrayus. It's talking about the 100 versus 200 part. When you write in the document, when you write in the Ksuba a field that's worth 100, that's not good enough. Mifnei Shur Tanai based in, because the Tanai based in that you have to do 200 regardless. The fact that everything else is achrayistic, that the Gemara is saying over here, Rabbi Yehuda would say it's not a question of Tanai based in, it's nothing something special about Ksuba. It's in general achrayis toh sofer. Achrayis is always implied.
And the Yoshim have a legal right to collect.
Yoshim is a different matter, actually. Yoshim gets into much more complicated issues. We're talking about here about a Baal Chayv, or we're talking about the woman herself collecting her Ksuba when the time comes. Yeah. So the problem with all that is, Reisha Rameyer v'Sefer Rabbi Yehuda. Are you telling me then that the first part of our Mishnah is a coincidence of Meyer and the second part is a coincidence of Yehuda? A Mishnah doesn't usually do that. V'chi tema kula Rameyer. He said, okay, you might answer the whole Mishnah is a coincidence of Meyer. V'shayni leila Rameyer ben Ksuba l'shtori. Maybe Rameyer would say there's a difference between a Ksuba and other documents. Maybe usually Rameyer would say Achrayus is not Torah Sefer. You have to write in Achrayus, otherwise it's not in effect. But when it comes to a Ksuba, maybe he would say it doesn't matter. It in effect, no matter what. Can't. Umi shiny lay. Do we really say that Rameyu makes that distinction? Valtanya, we learn in a braisa. Chamisha goven minam chulorin. There are five cases where somebody can collect, where a person can collect only from bnei chorin, only from property that's still owned by the person he's collecting from, not from third parties. The Elohein, and they are as follows. Number one, peiros. And number one and two, peiros or shvach peiros. It's like this. Rashi explains. Suppose that Reuven stole a field from Shimon and sold it to Levi illegally. Shimon is coming to get his field back from Levi. There can be payers, first of all. There can be peiros, and second of all, there can be shvach peiros, which is Levi may have put improvements into the field. He plowed it, he got rid of the rocks, whatever it is, he fertilized it, etc. The din is that Levi now, with the field and the shvach were taken away from him, is going and suing Reuven, the original Gazlan, in court. When it comes to the value of the property itself, he's entitled to collect from everything, from Bnei Chorin and from Mishabodim. So even if previously Reuven had sold a field to Yehuda, then Levi is entitled to go and seize that field and payment back. The improvements, the peiros and the shvach peiros, that he can only collect from Bnei Chorin, from property that is actually still in Levi's hands, right, in Reuven's hands right now. And the reason for that is, Rashi says, we mentioned the other day about the concept of Tikkun Olam. This is another one of those things. You want to allow for the free flow of buying and selling. You don't want, Mela, a person buys a field itself, fine. You know, he needs to be careful that there's clear title to it. When it comes to Peiros and Shvach, there might be no limit to those. If you were to say that Reuven is going to be on the hook, not Reuven, if you're going to say that Yehuda, a third party who previously bought from Reuven, is going to be on the hook that you can collect from him even the Peiros and Shvach Peiros, he might say, you know what, why should I bother buying anything from Reuven? I'm never going to buy anything because it may be a field, fine. You know, you check out, you know, you a field has a fixed value. But Peiros and Shvach Peiros don't necessarily.
So if you buy the Reuven buys the field from Shimon.
No, Reuven stole the field from Shimon. Sold it to Levi.
Well, before he sold it to Levi, he builds a huge building, 20 stories, and then he sells it to Levi. So what are we taking?
That's a different matter. The Gemara discusses that in Bava Metzia. There also all this is in Shneimos and in the first parak of Bava Metzia. Right. That's a different matter. Then Reuven himself. Reuven himself is able to Reuven himself, who put in expenses for it, is entitled to collect some of those expenses from Shimon, because ultimately Shimon gets back the field with a great improvement to it. Even though he stole it originally, but because he improved it, yeah, that's a complicated thing. Let's not get into it right now. Right now, what's important is it's not Reuven, the Gazlan, who improved the field or who had Peiros grow in it. It's Levi, the innocent third party who bought it, not realizing it was stolen. So now we're saying when Shimon comes and takes back the field together with the Peiros and together with the Shvach, so Levi goes and sues Reuven for the whole thing. As far as the value of the field itself, he can collect even from the Shvadim, even from property that Reuven previously sold to Yehuda. Whereas the Shvach and the Peiros, he can only collect from Reuven himself, not from any other third parties. So those are the first two. Number three, v'amakabal olav lozenus ben ishtoy bas ishtoy. If somebody took on himself that he's going to support the children of his wife from her previous marriage, same idea. It's not ketsuvin. There's no fixed value to them, so you can't expect a buyer of fields to know to look out for that. So again, it's a matter of tikkun olam. Number four, the get choyv she'en b'yachrayis. Number four, a get choyv. Rashi says over here that a get is a generic word for a star. So a star choyv that does not have achrayis. That's the key thing. That's why we're bringing this over here. That therefore, since there's no achrayis then on it, then he can't collect from the shabodim, only from bnei chorin. And number five, a ksuba sheish she'en b'yachrayis. A ksuba that doesn't have achrayis. Now, man shamat le'dom achrayis lav tos seifahu. So which Tana do we find previously that says that in a shtar choyv there's a difference between achrayis and not? That was Rebbe Meir. V'katoni ksubas isha. And we had, that was number four, and number five is a ksuba. So we see the same thing Rebbe Meir holds as far as achrayis in a shtar choyv is exactly the same thing he holds as far as a ksuba. So we're back to the question, what is our Mishnah talking about? How is it that the first part of the Mishnah, about that you must have 200 or 100, the wife can't be moichel on any part of it, as according to the mayor, but the part about there being a difference between whether you wrote achrayus or not, or not being a difference whether you wrote achrayus or not, rather, is according to the Yehuda. The answer is, Ibai Semer of Meir, Ibai Semer of Yehuda. You could say that the whole Mishnah is according to the mayor. You could say the whole Mishnah is according to the Yehuda. Namely, Ibai Semer of Yehuda, you could say the whole Mishnah is according to Rabbi Yehuda, because Hasam Kasvala Iskabalti, because the difference is, what is Rabbi Yehuda saying? That she's entitled to be Moicho on part of it. She can write out a document saying that I was Moicho on half of the Ksuba, that I received it, even when she really didn't. Hachala Kasvala Iskabalti, here in our Mishnah, she didn't write any such thing. He himself, so even Reb Meir is the one who says you have to, that it has to be 200 or 100, and less is Be'ilas Nus. Reb Yehuda wouldn't agree to that, because Reb Yehuda says it could be that ultimately you only have 100 or 50, respectively, but he would agree that if she didn't explicitly write out a document that says, you know what, I'm local on half of it, or, then we can't assume that she is. Then she's entitled to the full 200 or 100. Ibai Seymer Reb Meir, or you could say the whole Mishnah goes according to Reb Meir. My chayev to katani, because when the Mishnah says that, when the Mishnah says that even if he didn't write that all my nechasim are meshubad to the ksuba, we say chayev and peshu tnai based in, and all this time we were assuming that chayev means that the shibud applies even to property that he sold to third parties, which that was the problem we had, because your mayor says that if you didn't write that, then it's not included. But no, what does it mean? Chayev to katani mina mechurorin. It means that he's responsible to pay the rest of the 200 out of his own property. Not from property that he sold to third parties, because certainly, he himself is on the hook for the rest of the 200. So he wrote out a field which is really worth only 100, even though he claimed in the silver it's worth 200. Reb Meir would say, fine, you give her that field which is 100, and then we're going to go into your nechassim, what you currently own, not stuff that you previously sold, and take out another 100 to give her.
Personal guarantee.
Yeah. Then the Mishnah had continued with the next case, like Kos of Lachol. We have the case where the Mishnah had said that one of the Tnoi Ksuba is that the husband guarantees that he's going to release, that he's going to redeem his wife from captivity to bail her out of jail, in plain English. And if he didn't write that, then he's still chayev because it's Nai-based-in. And we mentioned that there's a difference between an Eishes Yisrael and an Eishes Koyin in that regard. An Eishes Yisrael, he's obligated to stay married to her, and actually the poskim say, the Rambam says that what if he does want to divorce her? He still, because of the Tanai Ksuba, he has to bring her back and bring her back to his house. Then at that point, if he wants to divorce her, fine. They're like any other husband and wife.
Eishes Levi is the same as Eishes Yisrael.
Yes. Whereas an Eishes Koyin, he doesn't have that option because he's a Shvuya, and therefore, yeah. So therefore, he has no choice but to divorce her, but he's guaranteeing that he's going to bring her back to her house. So in this connection, Amar Avor Dishmul, Eishes Yisrael, Shenensa Asur Labaila. If the wife of a Yisrael was raped, then she's also to her husband. Why? We said all this time that an Eishes Yisrael, there's no issue. The reason is Chayshin and Shema Tchilas of Oynes Maseifa Berotzen, because we have to be concerned that maybe the beginning of the rape was Ba'onis, it was against her will, but later on, like she sort of made peace with the situation as it's going on, and therefore it's Berotzen. We're going to learn soon the details about that. But actually, there are a couple of different mafarshim talk about whether so we don't give a Jewish woman a cheskes kashrus. One interesting answer the Haflah gives is it's not a question of her cheskes kashrus. We can consider, yes, even though when we say sofa beratzen, we're talking about she's physically unable to get away, so she's not chayev. We're not going to make her liable for any issur or anything. In that sense, we do consider it totally an oinah. But the case of Eishes Ish is a special case because the pasuk says, when does a woman become also to her husband umar loy boy mal, that she's like transgresses against him. So even if it's just a mental thing, even if physically she's unable to get away, but mentally in her mind she's thinking, you know what, I've made peace with the situation. That's already enough to make, it may not be enough to make her chayev for any kind of penalty, but it makes her, it's strong enough, according to Avodah Shmuel, to make her also to her husband.
Well, the time we spoke that she would be careful.
Wait. There's a difference. There can be a difference between Shavuya. We're talking about a regular case of rape over here. We're not talking about Shavuya. Wait. The Rav says, what are you talking about? Our Mishnah says, in Shaboy, if you get captured, Efrekinach, I will redeem you, Voisvinach Lila into her, and I'll bring you back as my wife. Implying that she's mutter to him, unless she's an Eishes Kayin. So obviously we're not concerned about this about this business. We're not even talking about the second time, within the first time. Yeah. Ishtik. So Avur Dishmul was quiet, he couldn't think of an answer. Kori Rav Aleid Avur Dishmul. So Rav applied the following pasuk. He said, this pasuk is talking about this case of Avur Dishmul. Sorim Otsru B'milim, the princes, like the great Tamar Chachamim, stopped their words, V'kafya Simulapim, and they put their hand to their mouth. Like, such a great Tamar Chacham, like Avur Dishmul, couldn't think of an answer. My Isla Lamema, what should he have answered? B'shvuya Hekeil, we could say, as we said before, that when it comes to a Shvuya, we're Mekel. Why? Because with a Shvuya, we have kind of a sex faker. This that Avur Shmuel is saying over here is a suffix. maybe at some point during it she made peace with it, and therefore it's considered beratzin. In the case of a shvuya, you have before that, there's even the question, was she b'chala raped or not? We had before the whole question whether she was or not. Also, yeah, there's the idea that we mentioned before in the second parak, that we mentioned that various Rishonim talk about the idea that a shvuya tends to try to make herself as unattractive as possible while she's in captivity, so that they don't pay any attention to her, whereas with a regular onus, we can't necessarily assume that. Yeah.
We had the case of the Bat Yisrael and Nachim, who said the Bat Yisrael, she always very careful.
Yeah.
Not to.
Well, yeah, as much as possible, but yeah. So we could have answered that yes, our mission is talking about a shavuya. Then she's mutter to go back to her husband. We're not concerned about this onus and rotzin business versus a regular case of onus where there's more of a concern of that. Okay, the question is, well, Avur de Shmuel, Onus de Shari Rachmana Hechem Ashkachasla. No, even Avur de Shmuel has to agree, as we're going to quote soon, Psukim, that the Torah implies that an Anusa, who's the wife of a Yisrael, of a Levi, is mutter to her husband, Hechem Ashkachasla. How do you find that? According to Avur de Shmuel, we're saying that even if it was Chilos of Onus, there's concern. That's safer for nothing.
Only the suffix, but it's
safe. But that's still, so Tosfos points out, it may be a suffix, but still apparently it's a strong enough suffix to make her actually alter midaraisa, because that's what Avur d'Shmuel was saying, that they're not allowed to stay married. The answer is, according to Avur d'Shmuel, Avur d'Shmuel would say, you know what the case is of an anrusa that the Torah is saying is mutter, where she was screaming throughout the whole thing, from beginning to end. Then obviously there was no rotzen anywhere in it. No, not done. But in other words, the fact that she's screaming and crying out shows that she didn't mentally make peace with it. Okay. You know.
Well, then should we go back to the suffix?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
We have a suffix. We don't know.
Yeah.
And her, and us.
Does a person really know their mental state at a time like that? Yes, if it's Masada, then yeah, we assume it's Sarkova and Mashiach, yeah.
Just talking about in this case that we heard her scream.
So if we heard her scream at the beginning, there's still the concern, according to Avur d'Shmuel, what if afterwards she made her peace with it,
right,
as the attack is going on, but if it's Mitzchil of Atzlaif, then we know the whole thing was Baroness. Then even Avur d'Shmuel would agree she's Mutter. Tosfos, by the way, points out, so what about Esther? She was with Ahasuerus for many years, and we've learned before that she remained mutter to Mordechai. So Tosfos gives the answer that she was a real tzaddikus. We learned before the concept, we learned in the connection with Yoel and Sisera, that somebody like that doesn't have any hana of any kind from a Be'ilah HaSura, and therefore there's more reason to be mekel, as opposed to the average person. Not necessarily, can you assume that? There's other answers as well that don't necessarily depend on the fact that the unique thing that Esther was tzaddikus. One of them being based on what the Gemara is going to say soon, that when you have an all-powerful king like Ahasuerus, then there's more reason to be lenient, because now she could get away from the situation anyway.
Especially knowing what happened to his previous wife.
Well, that's okay. Yeah, that's true. Okay. The Gemara points out, well, pligged the Rava. This that Avur d'Shmuel said disagrees with Rava. The Amar Rava, no, kol shetchilas ba'onus v'seif beratzen, if the beginning was ba'onus and the end of it was beratzen, afilu hi emeret, and even if, what happens if while she's being raped, you hear her calling out, hanichu loy, leave this guy alone, don't, you know, somebody's getting ready to kill him or wound him or whatever to get him off her, and she says, no, leave him alone. She omala le nizkakla, he secharpe. She's yelling out, you know what, if he hadn't come and started doing this, I have such a yetzer for it, I would have hired him to do it. Even then, muteres, which sounds like she's certainly berotzen, she should be also. No, muteres, she's still mutter. My time a yetzer albashah, because at that point, he, so to speak, dressed her up in a yetzer hara. But when it's human nature, Rashi says, It's human nature that once Be'ilah has started, a person naturally their body reacts to it, and they feel a certain hana from it. So like once it's started, it's too late to stop, basically. So therefore, yes, the fact that the beginning of it was bonus, that's enough to say that it's good enough even if the rest was nothing. Tanya Kasei D'Rava, we learn a brisa that goes. Tanya Kavatei, well, yes, the halacha is like Rava. Tanya Kavatei de Rava, and we learn a braise, in fact, like Rava. The pasuk says, "He lo nitpasa," that by a sota it says that if she was not grabbed, meaning raped, then Asura, then she's also to her husband. Hanit pasa muteres, which implies, but if she was forced, then she's muter to her husband. But the implication is, but you have another case of a woman who, even though she was not grabbed, even though she was not forced, nevertheless, she's muter to her husband, even though she had relations with somebody else. The ezu, and what kind of case is that? The ezuzu, kosher tchilas v'oynis v'sefer berdatzin. In this case, where the beginning was v'oynis, the rest was berdatzin, it's still, the end of it is loynis pasa, but nevertheless, because it's the albasha, then therefore we're being makel and saying that she's allowed to stay with her husband.
Wait, you mean
Kedavka? The Pashtus, we're not making a difference here. Usually, B'chol HaTorah Tekula, there's not a difference between Kedavka and Shalei Kedavka. But, yeah, but Pashtus over here, we mean Kedavka. Where do you see Barlea Derech Evarim?
My head.
What?
My head.
Okay. Oh, what if Barlea Derech Evarim? I don't know. I mean, then that doesn't answer her to her husband anyway. That's considered Pritzus in Halacha, but it's not considered anything that would answer her. Tanya Idach, then we learn in another Braisa, Vihilonit Pasa Asura, again we have this Pasik Vihilonit Pasa, that she was not raped, then she's Asura to her husband, Hanit Pasa Muteres, but if she was raped, then she's Muter, but Vyeshvacha Acheres Shafbishinit Pasa Asura, but you have a different case where even though she was raped, she's still Asura, the Ezu, Zu Eshes Kohen, namely the wife of Kohen. The Rambam, by the way, puts it a little bit differently.
Well,
we're mentioning, like, to complete the thing. But also, the Rambam explains it somewhat like this. The Rambam says, basically, this you have a pasuk that says, Achrei Asher Tamah. Once a woman has become tamei by having relations with somebody other than her husband, then she becomes also to him. We learned in Yevamos that applies to Maksa Gurushasai and Soita and so forth. Now, the Torah carves out an exemption by saying the Hebrew Nitosa, the Torah carves out an exemption for Yisrael. For a Kohen, that exemption doesn't apply. Therefore, the Rambam says she would be considered a Zayna, and also that the reason why she's also to her husband, the Kohen, is because the exemption of the Hebrew Nitosa, as the Gemara is saying over here, does not apply in the case of a Kohen. So therefore, according to the Rambam, the din of Achrei Asher Tamah should apply across the board. Even bonus, the pasuk, the Hilonit Pasa, which goes in opposition to that, tells us that there's a certain case, as we said, when because Nit Pasa she's mutter. Therefore, what is it? Achrei Asher Tamah ends up applying only to Kohenim. The Hilonit Pasa tells us that it does not apply to Yisraelim. But Eishes Kohen, you remain with Achrei Asher Tamah, and therefore the Rambam holds she's considered, and therefore the Rambam would hold she's considered a zayna for that. Many other Rishonim disagree with the Rambam and say that she is also to her husband, not necessarily under the thing of Zayna, might be under Chalala, whatever.
But on the issue of Ana, we're saying still that she's a Baskain, she doesn't have Ana, but she's Asura.
But that's what we're saying, because of the Kohen, we're saying that she's also to her husband, even if the whole thing was Ba'arinus, even if she was screaming through the whole thing,
right.
Which Avor D'Shmuel said, that even according to Avor D'Shmuel.
What's the Kiddush? I mean, we know that.
Okay, but the Gemara is mentioning it for completeness' sake. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel Mishum Rav Shmuel. Another thing we learn from this pasuk: Hilonit Pasa Asura. We say if she wasn't forced, then she's also to her husband. Hanit Pasa Muteres. But if she was, then she's Muter. V'Yeshla Acheres Shaf Kishon Nit Pasa Muteres. You have another case where even though she wasn't forced, she's still Muter to her husband. The Ezu. And what case is that? Zusha Kiddushay Kiddushay Tos. That's if the kiddushin were done under a mistaken premise. For example, Rashi gives the example. It was a kiddushin al tanai, and the tanai never ended up getting accomplished. So if she was mizana, she still remains mutter to her husband. What al tanai? For example, he made a tanai that I'm being makadosh you, I'm a nas shani tzadik, and not a shani tzadik. That actually it is chal. I'm makadosh you, I'm a nas that I what I'm a nas shani osher. Let's say, and it turns out he's not an osher. Yeah. So then, if she was mizana, she stays mutter to him because the kiddushin were never chal.
So they went and what do you mean mutar to him?
In other words, she can go. That fine, but they can go and do and redo kiddushin, and or he can do mekayim b'tnai at that point, and fine, she becomes his wife, and things continue from there.
But if she was not his wife in the first place, what do we
But that's the point. In other words, we don't say that the kiddushin were chal, and therefore she was an eshet. No, right. That's the point. We're saying the kedushin were chal. The kedushin were kedushitos.
Right.
So therefore, even if she has a child riding on her shoulder, Mamanis, Vahilakas law, she can still refuse to be with the second guy and return to the guy that she originally did these Kedusha Taurus with.
Do we have to have her think that she was married, or she knew that there was a Kedusha Taurus?
I mean, it sounds like we know that there was Kedusha Taurus. Amar Rav Yehuda, Hani Noshu de Ganvu Ganvi, women who were stolen away by thieves, Shayim the Gurvayu, they remain mutar to their husbands. We don't assume that they submitted to the thieves, and even if they did, it was bonus. Amri Leira Bonan Rav Yehuda, V'Hakam Mamti and Lahu Nama. Don't we see that when these women are in captivity, we see that they bring food to the Ganovim? Doesn't that mean that they've made peace with the situation? The answer is no. Machmas Yira, they're bringing it out of fear. They know that if they don't bring food to the Ganovim, they may kill them. Okay, how about V'Hakam Shalchan Lahu Giri? But we see that even they give them arrows when the Ganovim are in a shootout with the police or whatever. You see sometimes that these women are handing them weaponry. At Mela, as far as food, okay, they may feel they have no choice. Wouldn't they rather in the shootout that the Ganovim get killed and then they're free? Doesn't that show that they made peace with it? Now, again, the answer is Machmas Yira. Again, you could say it's because of fear, because the Shittuk Abetis explains the vote is that the Ganovim figure, you know what, we may survive the shootout anyway, and if the women don't help us, then we're going to kill them afterwards, if we're not helping us. On the other hand, Vaday, there's no question that Shavkinu v'Ozlon, that if the Ganovim said, you know what, you're free to go, but they return back to the Ganovim, Stockholm syndrome, then Ma'azim Minafshayu, when they go on their own, then Asirim, then for sure they're also. Stockholm syndrome, it's called, where people who were kidnapped start identifying with the kidnappers, with the terrorists, rather than their original. There was a case in the 70s of people in Stockholm who were taken as hostages, and they ended up, so that's where the name comes from, yeah.
And if there's enemies around these Ganavim, let's say, and they say, two or three women, just go.
No, we're talking about they said you're free to go home to your husbands, obviously, yeah. Tana Rabbana. Then they'd be off there, because then obviously they're staying, yeah. Tana Rabbana, let's finish this up quickly. Shvuyei Malchus Harein Kishvuyin, people who were captured by the government, are considered shavuyas, with all the dinim that we talked about before. Gnuve listus, but women who were stolen away by ganavim, ainin kishvuyin, they're not considered like shavuyas, like we just said. You must have Valtani Yimcha, but didn't we have, there's a braisa that says the other way around. The answer is malchus a malchus lakasha, there's no contradiction between the two statements about a kingdom. Habu malchus achashverish, habu malchus ben netzer. One is talking about the kingdom of Ahasuerus, who's a real legitimate. He's a great monarch. He's a world power. Versus Ben Netzer Rashi says listim haya. He was originally a plain old Ghana who just he got power and he became like a local warlord kind of. So that would make a difference. I'll explain in a second why. Listus a listus leikasha. There's also no contradiction between the two statements about listim. Hoba ben netzer, hoba listim de alma. Because one's talking about ben netzer, one's talking about plain old listim, people who are on a lower level than ben netzer. In other words, ben netzer is kind of somewhere in the middle between Achashverosh and the others. So what's the difference? Rashi says the vote is like this. Achashverosh, a woman knows that he took her, like Achashverosh took all these women. What's the chance he's actually going to marry me and make me the queen? Very low. So we can assume that any deal that he did with her was bonus. On the other hand, with Ben Netzer, where he's a more local warlord, yeah, he doesn't rule over a large area anyway. Maybe just any woman he gets has a very good chance of becoming his queen. There's maybe more of a chance that she submits to him willingly. On the other hand, with a plain old listim, she has nothing to gain really from being the wife of a leader of a band of robbers. Therefore, again, we would assume that it's bonus. If another Rishonim talk about, they say, so what are you talking about? You're saying again that you're gonna take away the cheskas kashrus of a woman because she thinks what she thinks her chances are of becoming queen or not. So there's various other answers. Rabbeinu Hananel explains that the vote is that Achashverosh, we know, was shot with Bezima. He was a very immoral, promiscuous kind of guy. So again, a woman who's taken by him, it's not a question of whether she knows that there's a chance of becoming queen or not. She knows, realistically, she's not going to get away from him. Ben Netzer was apparently a more moral guy in this kind of thing. He's not necessarily going to take women and start putting them into his harem or raping them or whatever. So therefore, if a woman ends up with him and ends up having had relations with him, there's more reason to assume that she did it willingly. And then as far as the listim, again, you know, she may figure she doesn't have much of a choice. The listim basically has nothing to lose. And then Ramban brings a little refinement on this. He says, who's the Ben Netzer over here? Pashto says that Ben Netzer was, he's mentioned in a couple of other sources, he was the king of a little state in what's nowadays Syria, sort of on the border between the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire. So like he tried to play one off against the other. But the Ramban says, you know who the Ben Netzer is here? Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, we find in the Medrash, the Medrash on Eicha says, that he told his soldiers when they were coming to capture Yerushalayim, he told them, you know what, we want to make sure that the Jewish God doesn't get angry at us and prevent us from winning. We know that he hates immorality, like Caleb Shalayla Zonazima. Make sure that you don't rape any married women. Unmarried women, fine, they're free for the taking, but no, married women are off limits. So therefore, if a woman is captured by Ben Netzer, by Nebuchadnezzar's army, and she's married, there's no reason to suspect that they're based on Nebuchadnezzar's orders. They're going to be careful to stay away from her. If she winds up, so therefore, that's the difference. By Achashverosh, she may end up being raped by him and put in his harem because that's the kind of thing he does. A listim also, that's the kind of thing he does. Ben Netzer, not.
Achashverosh
was an immoral kind of guy. He didn't make a difference. It says over there even that when he ran out of bisolus, he started taking bisolus as well. Yeah. Whereas Nebuchadnezzar, in that sense, was a little more moral. The question is, the Gemara asks, Ben Netzer, Hasam Kari Le Melech, Vahach Kari Le Listim. So what, if you're saying that the two things of the king are Achashverosh versus Ben Netzer, and the two things about the Listim are Ben Netzer versus a regular robber, so what is Ben Netzer? Is he a king or is he a robber? The answer is the guy be Achashverosh Listim, or relative to Achashverosh, he's like a Listim, because he's not such a major power. The guy be Listim to Alma, whereas regular, relative to a regular, to Stam, a leader of a band of robbers, Melech, who relative to them, he's a king. Yeah. Yeah.